Hey guys, a long time no read, I know. So, okay, new book. I will give you the synopsis of A Dirty Job, the end. But for right now, everybody lives happily ever after, okay? Moving on. This is my first and favorite Vonnegut book that I have read. The time is all wrong, so you have to pay attention, or you'll miss something. Ready? You're listening to Damned. I'm your storyteller, and this is Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. All of this happened, more or less. The war parts, anyway, they're pretty much true. One guy I knew really was shot in Dresden for taking a teapot that wasn't his. Another guy I knew really did threaten to have his personal enemies killed by hired gunmen after the war. And so on. I've changed all the names. I really did go back to Dresden with Guggenheim money, God love it, in 1967. It looked like a lot like Dayton, Ohio. More open spaces than Dayton has. There must be tons of human bone meal in the ground. I went back there with an old war buddy, Bernard V. O'Hare, and we made friends with the taxi driver who took us to the slaughterhouse where he had been locked up at night as a prisoner of war. His name was Gerhard Mueller. He told us that he was a prisoner of the Americans for a while. We asked him how it was to live under communism, and he said it was terrible at first because everybody had to work so hard and because there wasn't much shelter, food, or clothing. But things are much better now. He had a pleasant little apartment, and his daughter was getting an excellent education. His mother was incinerated in the Dresden firestorm. So it goes. I sent O'Hare a postcard at Christmas time, and here's what it said. I wish you and your family also, as to your friends, Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and I hope that we will meet again in a world of peace and freedom in the taxi cab, if the accident will. I like that very much. If the accident will. I would hate to tell you that this lousy little book cost me in money and anxiety and time. When I got home from the Second World War 23 years ago, I thought it would be easy for me to write about the destruction of Dresden, since all I would have to do is report what I've seen. And I thought that would make a masterpiece, or at least make me a lot of money, since the subject was so big. But not many words about Dresden came from my mind. Then not enough of them to make a book. Anyway. And not too many words come now either, when I have become an old fart with his memories and his paw malls, with his sons full grown, and I think how useless the Dresden part of my memory has been, and yet how tempting Dresden has been to write about. And I am reminded of the famous limerick. There was a young man from Stamboul who sequelized thus his tool. You took all my wealth, you ruined my health, and now you won't pee, you old fool. And I remember too of the song that goes, my name is Janssen, I work in Wisconsin, I work in a lumber mill there. The people I meet when I walk down the street say, "What's your name?" And I say, "My name is Jan Janssen. I work in Wisconsin." And so on to infinity. Over the years, people I've met have often asked me what I'm working on. And I've usually replied that the main thing was a book about Dresden. I said to Harrison Starr, the movie maker, one time, and he raised his eyebrow and inquired, "Is it a anti-war book?" "Yes," I said, "I guess." You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? "No, what do you say, Harrison Starr?" I say, "Why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead?" What he meant, of course, was there was always going to be wars, and they're going to be as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe it, too. And even if wars didn't keep coming like glaciers, there would still be plain old death. When I was somewhat younger, working on my famous Dresden book, I asked an old war buddy of mine, Bernard V. O'Hare, if I could come see him. He was a district attorney in Pennsylvania. I was a writer in Cape Cod. We had been privates in the war, infantry scouts. We hadn't never expected to make any money after the war, but we were doing quite well. I had the Bell Telephone Company find him for me. They are wonderful in that way. I have this disease late at night involving alcohol and the telephone. I get drunk and I drive my wife away with breaths like mustard gas and roses. And then, speaking gravely and elegantly into the telephone, I ask telephone operators to contact me with this friend or that one, from whom I have not heard from in years. I got O'Hare on the line in his way. He was short and I am tall. We were Mutt and Jeff in the war. We were captured together in the roar. I told him who I was on the telephone, and he had no trouble believing. He was up. He was reading. Everybody in the house was asleep. "Listen," I said, "I'm writing this book about Dresden, and I'd like some help remembering stuff. I wonder if I could come down and see you. We could drink and talk and remember." He was unenthusiastic. He said he couldn't remember much. He told me, though, "Come on ahead. I think the climax of the book will be the execution of old poor Edgar Derby," I said. The irony was so great. The whole city gets burned down and thousands of people killed, and this one American foot soldier is arrested in the ruins for taking a teapot. He is given a regular trial and then shot by a firing squad. Said O'Hare, "Don't you know that's really where the climax should come?" "I don't know anything about it," he said. "That's your trade, not mine. As a trafficker in climaxes and thrills and characterizations and wonderful dialogue and suspense and confrontations, I had outlined the Dresden story many times. The best outline I ever made, or anyway the prettiest one, was on the back of a roll of wallpaper. I used my daughter's crayons, a different color for each main character. One end of the wallpaper was the beginning of the story, and the other was the end. And then there was the middle part, which was the middle. And the blue line met the red line, and the yellow line and the yellow line stopped because the character represented by the yellow line was dead, and so on. The destruction of Dresden was represented by a vertical band of orange cross-hatching all the lines that were still alive, passed through it, came out the other side. In the end, where all the lines stopped, there was a beet field on the eve outside a hall. The rain was coming down. The war in Europe had been over for a couple of weeks. We were formed in ranks with Russian soldiers guarding us, Englishmen, Americans, Dutchmen, Belgians, Frenchmen, Canadians, South Africans, New Zealand, Australians, thousands of us about to stop being prisoners of war. And on the other side of the field, there were thousands of Russians and Poles and Yugoslavians and so on, guarded by American soldiers. An exchange was made there, in the rain, one for one. O'Hare and I climbed into the back of an American truck with lots of others. O'Hare didn't have many souvenirs. Almost everyone else did. I had a ceremony Luftwaffe saber. I still do. The rabid little American I call Paul Lazaro in this book had about a quart of diamonds, emeralds, and rubies, and so on. He had taken these from the dead people in the cellars of Dresden. So it goes. An idiotic Englishman who had lost all his teeth somewhere had his souvenir in a canvas bag. The bag was resting on my insteps. He would peek into the bag every now and then, and he would roll his eyes and swivel his scrawny neck, trying to catch people looking covertly around his bag. He would bounce the bag on my insteps. I thought the bouncing was accidental, but I was mistaken. He had to show somebody what was in the bag. And he had decided he could trust me. He caught my eye and winked and opened the bag. There was a plaster model of the Eiffel Tower in it. It was painted gold and had a clock on it. "There's a smashing thing," he said. And we were flown to the rest camp in France, where we were fed chocolate, malted milkshakes, and other rich foods until we were all covered baby fat. And then we were sent home, and I married a pretty girl who was covered with baby fat, too. And we had babies. They're all grown up now. I'm an old fart with his memories and his Pall Malls. My name is Jan Janssen. I work in Wisconsin. I work in the lumber mill there. Sometimes I try to call up old girlfriends on the telephone late at night after my wife's gone to bed. "Operator, I wonder if you could give me the number of Miss So-and-so. I think she lives in such-and-such." "I'm sorry, sir, there's no such listing." "Thanks, operator. Thanks just the same." And I let the dog out, or I let the dog in, and we talk some. I let him know I like him. He lets me know he likes me, and that he doesn't mind the smell of mustard gas and roses. "You're all right, Sandy," I'll say to the dog. "You know that, Sandy? You're okay." Sometimes I'll turn on the radio and listen to a talk program from Boston, New York. I can't stand recorded music if I've been drinking a good deal. Sooner or later, I go to bed and my wife asks me what time it is. She always has to know the time. Sometimes I don't know. And sometimes I say, "Search me." I think about my education sometimes. I went to the University of Chicago for a while after the Second World War. I was a student in the Department of Anthropology. At that time, they were teaching that there was absolutely no difference between anybody. They may be teaching that still. Another thing they taught was that nobody was ridiculous or bad or disgusting. Shortly before my father died, he said to me, "You know, you never wrote a book with a villain in it." I told him that was one of the things I learned in college after the war. While I was studying to be an anthropologist, I was also working as a police reporter for the famous Chicago City News Bureau for $28 a week. One time, they switched me from the night shift to the day shift, so I worked 16 hours straight. We were supported by all of the newspapers in town, and the AP and the UP and all that. And we would cover the courts and the police stations and the fire department and the Coast Guard up on Lake Michigan and all of that. We were connected by the institutions that supported us by means of pneumatic tubes that ran under the streets of Chicago. Reporters would telephone in stories to writers wearing headphones, and the writers would stencil the stories onto the mimeograph sheets. The stories were then mimeographed and stuffed into brass and velvet cartridges, which the pneumatic tubes ate. Very toughest reporters and writers were women who had taken over the jobs of men who had gone to war. And at the first story I ever covered, I had to dictate over the telephone to one of those beastly girls. I was a young veteran who had taken a job running an old-fashioned elevator in a office building. The elevator door was on the first floor, was ornamental iron lace. Iron ivy snaked in and out of the holes. There was an iron twig with two iron lovebirds perched upon it. This veteran decided to take his car into the basement, where he closed the door and started down. But his wedding ring was all caught up in the ornaments. So he was hoisted into the air, and on the floor of the car went down, dropped out from under him on top of the car, and squashed him. So it goes. So I phoned this in, and the woman who was going to cut the stencil asked me, what did his wife say? She doesn't know yet, I say. It just happened. We'll call her up and get a statement. What? Tell her you're Captain Finn of the police department, and you have some sad news. Give her the news and see what she says. So I did. She said about what you would expect her to say. There was a baby. And so it goes. When I got back to the office, the woman writer asked me, just for her information, what the squashed guy had looked like when he was squashed. I told her. Did it bother you? She said. She was eating a Three Musketeers candy bar. Heck no, Nancy, I've seen a lot worse that in the war. Even then, I was supposedly writing the book about Dresden. It wasn't a famous air raid back then in America. Not many Americans knew how much worse it had been than Hiroshima, for instance. I didn't know that either. There hadn't been much publicity. I happened to tell a University of Chicago professor at a cocktail party about the raid, as I had seen it, about the book I was writing. He was a member of a thing called the Committee of Social Thought. He told me about the concentration camps and about how the Germans made soap and candles out of the fat of dead Jews and so on. All I could say was, I know. The Second World War had made everybody just very tough. I became a public relations man for General Electric in Schenectady, New York, and a volunteer fireman in the village of Appaloose, where I bought my first home. My boss was one of those toughest guys I ever met. He had been a lieutenant colonel in public relations in Baltimore. While I was in Schenectady, I joined the Dutch Reformed Church, which was a very tough church indeed. He used to ask me sneeringly sometimes why I hadn't been an officer, as though I had done something wrong. My wife and I had lost our baby fat. Those were our scrawny years. We had lots of scrawny veterans and lots of scrawny wives for friends. The nicest veterans were in New York, I thought. The kindest and funny ones, the ones who hated the war the most, were the ones who really fought. I wrote the Air Force back then, asking for details about the raid in Dresden. Who ordered it? How many planes did it? Why they did it? What desirable results there had been? And so on. I was answered by a man who, like myself, was in public relations. He said that he was very sorry, but that information was top secret still. I read the letter out loud to my wife, and I said, "Secret? My God, from whom?" We were the United World Federalists back then. I don't know what we are now. Telephoners, I guess. We telephone a lot, or I do, anyway, late at night. A couple weeks after I telephoned my old war buddy, Bernard V. O'Hare, I really did go to see him. It must have been 1964 or so. Whatever, it was the last year for the New Year's, New York's World's Fair. My name is Jan Janssen. There's a young man from Istanbul. I took two little girls with me, my daughter, Nanny, and her best friend, Allison Mitchell. They'd never been off Cape Cod before. When we saw a river, they had to stop so they could stand by it and think about it for a while. They had never seen water in that long and narrow, unsalted form before. The river was the Hudson. There were carp in there, and we saw them. They were as big as atomic submarines. We saw waterfalls, too. Streams jumping off cliffs into the valley of the Delaware. There were lots of things to stop and see, and it was time to go. Always time to go. The little girls were wearing white party dresses and black party shoes, so strangers would know how nice they were. Time to go, girls, I would say, and we would go. And the sun went down, and we had supper at an Italian place, and then I knocked on the front door of the beautiful stone house of Bernard V. O'Hare. I was carrying a bottle of whiskey, like a dinner bell. I met his nice wife, Mary, to whom I dedicate this book. I dedicate to Gerard Mueller and the Dresden taxi driver, and Mary O'Hare, who's a trained nurse, which is a lovely thing for a woman to be. Mary admired the two little girls I had brought, mixed them up with her own children, and sent them upstairs to play games and watch television. It was only after the children were gone that I sensed that Mary did not like me, or she did not like something about the night. She was polite, but chilly. "It was a nice cozy house you have here," I said, and it really was. "I fixed the place up where you can talk and not be bothered," she said. "Good," I said, and I imagined two leather chairs near a fire in a paneled room where two old soldiers could drink and talk. But she put us in the kitchen. She'd put two straight-backed chairs at a kitchen table with a white porcelain top. The tabletop was screaming with reflected light from the 200-watt bulb overhead. Mary had prepared an operating room, but she only had one glass on it, which was for me. She explained that O'Hare couldn't drink the hard stuff since the war. So he sat down. O'Hare was embarrassed, but he wouldn't tell me what was wrong. I couldn't imagine it was about me that could burn up Mary so. I was a family man. I'd only been married once, and I wasn't a drunk, and I hadn't done her husband any dirt in the war. She fixed herself a Coca-Cola and made a lot of banging in the ice cube tray in the stainless steel sink. Then she went into another part of the house, but she wouldn't sit still. She was moving all over the house, opening and shutting doors, even moving furniture around to work off anger. I asked O'Hare what I had done to make her act that way. "It's all right," he said. "Don't worry about it. It has nothing to do with you." That was kind of him. He was lying. It had everything to do with me. So we tried to ignore Mary and remember the war. I took a couple belts of the booze I had brought. Then we'd chuckle or grin sometimes, as though the war stories were coming back, but neither one of us could remember anything good. O'Hare remembered one guy who got into a lot of wine in Dresden before it was bombed, and we had to take him home in a wheelbarrow. It wasn't much to write a book about. I remember two Russian soldiers who looted a clock factory. They had horse-drawn wagons full of clocks. They were happy and drunk. They were smoking huge cigarettes they had rolled with newspapers. And that was it for memories. Mary was still making noise. Finally, she came out to the kitchen again for another Coke. She took another tray of ice cubes from the freezer, banged it in the sink, even though there was already plenty of ice out. Then she turned to me to let me see how angry she was, and that anger was for me. She had been talking to herself, so that's what she said was a fragment of a much larger conversation. "You were just babies then," she said. "What?" I said. "You were just babies in the war, like the ones upstairs." I nodded as if this were true. We had been foolish virgins in the war, right at the end of our childhood. "But you're not going to write it that way, are you?" It wasn't a question. It was an accusation. "I don't know," I said. "Well, I know," she said. "You pretend that you were men instead of babies, and you'll be played in the movies by Frank Sinatra and John Wayne or some of those other glamorous, war-loving, dirty old men. And the war will look just wonderful, so we'll have a lot more of them. And then they'd be fought by babies like the babies upstairs." So then I understood. It was the war that made her so angry. She didn't want her babies, or anybody else's babies, killed in the war. And she thought wars were partly encouraged by books and movies. So I held up my right hand and made her promise. "Mary," I said, "I don't think this book is ever going to be finished. I must have written 5,000 pages by now, and then thrown them all away. If I ever do finish it, though, I'll give you my word of honor there won't be any part for Frank Sinatra or John Wayne. I'll tell you what," I said, "I'll call it the Children's Crusade." She was my friend after that. O'Hare and I gave up on remembering, went into the living room and talked about other things. We became curious about the real Children's Crusade, so O'Hare looked it up in a book he had. Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles McKay, LLD. It was first published in London in 1841. Mackie had a low opinion of all the Crusades. The Children's Crusade struck him as only slightly more sordid than the other 10 Crusades for grown-ups. O'Hare read this handsome passage out loud. History, in her solemn page, informs us that the Crusades were but ignorant and savage men. Their motives were those of bigotry and mitigated, and their pathway was one of blood and wars. Romance, on the other hand, dilates upon their piety and heroism, and portrays her in the most glowing and impassioned hues. Their virtue, the imperishable honor they acquired for themselves, and the great services they rendered for Christianity. Then O'Hare read this. Now, what was the grand result of all these struggles? Europe expended millions of her treasures, and the blood of 2 million people and a handful of quarrelsome knights retained possession of Palestine for 100 years. Mackie told us that the Children's Crusade started in 1213 when two monks got the idea of raising armies of children in Germany and France and started selling them in North Africa as slaves. 30,000 children volunteered. They were thinking they'd go into Palestine. They were no doubt idle and deserted children who generally swarmed in great cities, nurtured on vice and daring, said Mackay, and ready for anything. Pope Innocent III thought they were going to Palestine too, and he was thrilled. These children are awake while we sleep, he said. Most of the children were shipped out of Marseille, and about half of them drowned on shipwrecks. The other half got to North Africa, where they were sold. Through a misunderstanding, some children reported for duty at Genoa, where there were no slave ships waiting. They were fed, sheltered, questioned kindly by good people there, then given a little money, a lot of advice, and sent back home. Hooray for the good people of Genoa, said Mary O'Hare. I slept that night in one of the children's bedrooms. O'Hare had put a book out for me on the bedside table. It was Dresden, History, Stage, and Gallery by Mary Endel. It was published in 1908, and its introduction began. It is hoped that this little book will make itself useful. Its attempts to give an English reading public a bird's eye view of how Dresden came to look as it does, architecturally, and how it expanded musically through the genius of a few men to the present bloom that calls attention to certain permanent landmarks in art that make its gallery the resort of those seeking lasting impressions. I read some history further on. Now, in 1760, Dresden underwent siege by the Prussians. On the 15th of July began a cannonade. The picture gallery took fire. Many of the paintings had been transported to the Kongenstein, but some were seriously injured by the splinters of bombshells, notably Franca's Baptism of Christ. Furthermore, the stated Kirkse Tower, which the enemy movements had been watched every day and every night, stood in flames. It was later succumbed. In a sturdy contrast with the pitiful fate of the Kirkse stood the Frankenkirche, from the curves of whose stone dome the Prussian bombs rebounded like rain. Frederick was obliged finally to give up the siege, because he learned of the fall of the Glatz, the critical point of his new conquest. We must be off to Silesia, so that we do not lose everything. The devastation of Dresden was boundless. When Goethe was a young student visiting the city, he still found sad ruins. Von der Kuppe, du Wrekenstein, sah ich Lina Young, Jeff, and the rest is all in German. So, I don't know what it says. And I'm not even going to try to speak German because it's going to sound ridiculous. Alright. The two little girls and I crossed the Delaware River where George Washington had crossed it the next morning. We went to the New York World's Fair, saw what the past had been like, according to the Ford Motor Company, and Walt Disney saw the future would be like, according to General Motors. And I asked myself about the present, and how wide it was, how deep it was, how much was it mine to keep. I taught creative writing in the famous author's workshop at the University of Iowa for a couple years after that. I got into some perfectly beautiful trouble and then got out of it again. I taught in the afternoons. In the mornings, I wrote. I was not to be disturbed. I was working on my famous book about Dresden. And somewhere in there was a nice man named Seymour Lawrence who had given me a 3-book contract. And I said, okay, the first of the 3 will be my favorite famous book about Dresden. Friends of Seymour Lawrence call him Sam. So I say to Sam now, Sam, here's the book. It was so short, jumbled and jangled. Sam, because there's nothing intelligent to say about a massacre. Everyone is supposed to be dead, to never say anything, or want anything to ever happen again. Everything is supposed to be very quiet after a massacre. And it always is, except for the birds. And what do the birds say? All there is to say about a massacre. Things like, pooty-dweet, pooty-dweet. I told my sons that they are not under any circumstances to take part in any massacres, and that the news of massacres of enemies is not to fill them with satisfaction or glee. I also told them not to work for companies in which make massacre machinery, to express contempt for the people who think we need machinery like that. I said it recently when I went back to Dresden with my friend O'Hare. We had a million lives in Hamburg and West Berlin and East Berlin and Vienna and Salzburg and Helsinki and then Leningrad too. It was very good for me because I saw a lot of authentic backgrounds for made-up stories that I would write later on. One of them would be Russian Baroque, and the other would be No Kissing, and the other will be Dollar Bar, and another will be If the Accident Will, and so on, and so on. There was a Lufthansa plane that was supposed to fly from Philadelphia to Boston to Frankfurt. O'Hare was supposed to get on in Philadelphia, and I was going to get on in Boston. And off we'd go. But Boston was socked in, so the plane flew straight from Frankfurt to from Philadelphia. And I became a non-person in the Boston fog, and the Lufthansa put me in a limousine with some other non-persons and sent us to the motel for a non-night. time would not pass. Somebody was playing with the clocks. And not only with the electric clocks, but the wind-up ones, too. The second hand on my watch would twitch once, and a year would pass, and it would twitch again. And there was nothing I could do about it. As an earthling, I had to believe whatever clocks said in calendars. I had two books with me, which meant I meant to read on the plane. One was Words for the Wind by Theodore Roque, and this is what I found in there. I wake to sleep, and I take my waking slow. I feel my feet late in what I cannot fear. I learn by going where I have to go. My other book was Erica Ostrowski, Celine, and His Vision. Celine was a brave French soldier from the First World War until his skull was cracked, and after that he couldn't sleep, and there were noises in his head, so he became a doctor, and he treated poor people in the daytime, and he wrote grotesque novels all night. No art is possible without a dance with death, he wrote. The truth is death, he wrote. I fought nicely against it as long as I could. Danced with it, festooned it, waltzed it around, decorated it with streamers, titillated it. Time obsessed him. Miss Ostrowski reminded me of the amazing scene in Death on the Installment Plan, where Celine wants to stop the bustling street crowd. He screams on the paper, "Make them stop! Don't let them move anymore. There, make them stop, once and for all, so they won't disappear anymore." I looked through my Gideon Bible in my motel room for the great tales of destruction. The sun was risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar, I read. Then the Lord rained down upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven, and he overthrew those cities, and in all the plain, and all the inhabitants of these cities, and which grew upon the ground. So it goes. Those were vile people in both of those cities. As well known, the world was better off without them. And Lot's wife, of course, was told not to look back where all those people and their homes had been. But she did look back. I love her for that, because it was so human. She was turned into a pillar of salt. So it goes. People aren't supposed to look back. I'm certainly not going to do it anymore. I finished my war book now. The next one is going to be fun. This one is a failure. It had to be, since it was written by a pillar of salt. It begins like this. Listen. Billy Pilgrim has become unstuck in time. And it ends like this. Pool tweet, pool tweet. Did you pay attention? Do you have the timeline in your head yet? Because we know that time in this is not linear. You are listening to Damned. I am your storyteller. And this is Slaughterhouse 5 by Kurt Vonnegut. Did you listen? Were you paying attention enough to know that that chapter didn't read right? It felt all wrong, didn't it? Till you got to the end of the chapter, and we find out that Billy Pilgrim is unstuck in time. And then it makes a little bit more sense of why it felt like it was bouncing around. So I'll be back with chapter 2 very soon. Until then, you are listening to Damned. I'm your storyteller. And this concludes chapter 1 of Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. Damned can be found on most platforms, Apple, Google, Spotify, and so on. You can also find me at Twitter at damnbooks_451. That's also the Instagram handle at damnbooks_451. Or you can visit my other Instagram, which is palmetto_and_pearls. That has a lot of my artwork, as you can see. You can also send me an email at bravocharlie.charlie.96.79@gmail.com. And I have a Medium where I write. You can find me at medium.com/itsallinyourhead1. All one thing. It's all in your head one. And I think that's where you can find me. Lots of places. So go see my art. Go read what I write. And be back here to listen to what I read. I hope you're someplace where it's beautiful and nothing hurts.